Kayla, we have had so much support.
You know, we have, and it's been overwhelming and heartwarming all at the same time. I definitely didn't expect the outpouring of support that we've received, and I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you, especially because my own alma mater, you know, shouted me out. That's Cal Poly Pomona, and they recognized our podcast, and that was super cool. So just thank you all for listening.
We have over 50 people that's subscribing and listening so far. And that's amazing since we just came out and just dropped our first episode only a week ago.
Yeah, so thank you guys. I mean, look, this is just a little side gig that we're doing. It's just our own little project that we decided to do, but we're passionate about it nonetheless, and we work hard to produce this content. And you guys just taking the time to listen or even share and like the podcast has been amazing. So thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We are gonna bring you more fresh, more lively, more beautiful content about all the anthropological things that we got going on here and on our campus and in the outside world.
Yeah.
We are here to make anthropology a legible discipline to everybody.
Yes, please continue to listen and share. And if you are so inclined to continue to show your support, please give us a 5-star rating on whatever streaming platform you're using.
Welcome. We want to welcome you to another episode of In the Thick, an anthropological podcast with Brianna
and Kayla.
And today our topic is, drumroll.
Yes, it is the student debt deficit,
which is a very big topic, especially here in the United States of America.
And especially from two students who are graduate students that went through the Cal State system to get their education.
Exactly.
It's something that affects the two of us, and it probably affects a lot of you guys out there who are listening, or if not you, definitely somebody that you know.
Yeah, it does. Many students are plagued with thousands, tens of thousands of dollars of debt that they cannot fathom about paying back.
Right. And you know, I think definitely I know that I was told growing up that the only way to get a good job is to go to college, but yet it's so expensive to go to college, and it's just really a double-edged sword, you know. And even when we think about the financial sacrifice of college and pursuing an education, a lot of people don't realize there's so much more sacrifice that comes with pursuing an education. And you know, when you combine student debt with the inability to be able to buy a house, or putting that goal on hold, or starting a family, or getting married, or just other types of things, you know, education, when you pursue an education, often you have to sacrifice somewhere. And it isn't always financially.
Right. A lot of the times, everybody thinks that sacrificing in college is like you just have to sacrifice, you know, sleepless nights.
Right, eating top ramen, I think.
Yeah, constant.
But it's so much more than that.
It's like you have to think about sacrificing your future of getting, like, a house right out of college.
Right, you know, the trying to navigate getting a career afterwards, or,
right.
You know, we are graduate students, but after you graduate with your bachelor's, you know, making that decision to go back to school to get a graduate degree is really oftentimes challenging. And, you know, if you're out there and you're going to school or you went to school, we're here for you. We feel you. We know the struggle. We support you. And if you haven't, but you have friends or family or loved ones that are, support them. It's tough. It's challenging. Be there for them. We need you. We love people that support us, so support your friends and family that are pursuing their education, because it's not an easy decision by any means.
Yeah, it's not. It's a huge sacrifice.
So yeah, this episode we're going to talk a little bit about politics as well, and the election upcoming, and Tuesday just passed, and the California primary election just passed. But that does not mean it's too late for you to register to vote, and it's important that you register to vote. So we have a big election coming up in November. Tuesday, November 3rd is the general election. You guys, register to vote.
Please do.
You have to register before October 20th. And I know that seems like a long time away, but if you're a college student, you're a master procrastinator. Do not procrastinate. Register to vote. 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 I can't say it anymore.
Because your voting voice is definitely going to be the change that we need to change the student debt deficit. As our guest, we'll talk about today that voting, putting the right person in office, not even just in major elections, but in local elections as well, it will most definitely help us resolve this issue.
Yes, definitely. And so if you haven't registered to vote yet, or if you didn't participate in the primary election, it's not too late. You can do it from home. You can do it from the comfort of your bed. Just stop scrolling on Instagram for like 3 minutes. Go to usa.gov. There you can learn how to vote. There's multiple ways, but there's a really easy way. You can do it online. Just take that break from scrolling, register to vote, get ready, cast your vote before November 3rd.
Yes, yes. Find your local polling places, people.
Yes, get and out volunteer there. If you can.
If you can.
You know?
It looks great.
Yeah.
And like you will be more a part of the democratic system.
Yes, you know, it's just important to participate and to get your, you know, cast your ballot, get your voice out there. And I know there's a lot of apathy with voting, especially amongst, well, I wouldn't say millennials, actually, but there's a lot of voter apathy. So, you know, just it doesn't hurt to vote, you know?
It doesn't.
It doesn't hurt to vote.
It doesn't.
So with that being said, I think we're ready to bring in our next guest, who is also very passionate about voting.
Yes, guess she is. We have today Dr. Missy Maseko.
Yes.
Who is a professor here at Cal State Long Beach. And she is a professor of not only anthropology, but linguistics as well. Like, linguistics is different. It's in the anthropological realm, but it's
right.
It has its own little flair.
Yeah, so this is also another thing that I think if you're not an anthropologist, this is going to be something you don't know most likely. So imagine anthropology as an umbrella. And under anthropology, there's many subfields. So there's archaeology, physical anthropology, or also known as biological anthropology, cultural anthropology, and linguistics. Linguistics is language, essentially. Its use, all those sorts of things. I know I'm not doing it justice, but I definitely am not a linguist.
Me either.
So,
total requirement.
But we're all one field.
Yeah.
There's a lot. Anthropology, as we've been saying, it goes everywhere. So it definitely is expansive. So you're going to hear from a linguistic anthropologist and hear her research a little bit and see, you know, all the ways in which anthropology is different.
As she will tell you from her multiple degrees and the different majors and her educational career, she has taken a little piece of everything, not just anthropology, but all sorts of other disciplines. And she has combined them all into one, which I think is really beautiful. And it definitely sums up the meaning of anthropology for us, as we told you guys on the first episode. Anthropology is everything. We study everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
Definitely.
We have an amazing professor here. From the Cal State Long Beach Department of Anthropology, we have Dr. Missy Maseko. Applause button here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And so today she's going to talk about the student debt deficit, which is a very important topic.
And it's a hot topic right now.
It's a hot topic. I feel like, yeah, we're both in student debt.
Yeah, wouldn't talk about that.
So we're just going to, she actually did a teach-in not too long ago, maybe like a couple weeks ago?
2 weeks.
2 weeks ago on the topic. So we're just going to like kind of pick her brain about it, kind of see like how this got started, what it is, like what can we do about it,
and why it's important.
And why it's important.
Okay, so I'm here to solve the student debt crisis.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
You're the sole person that can solve it.
Got it.
All on your own.
Done.
Yeah. So I guess you can go and introduce yourself, say what you do, anything.
Okay.
The floor is yours.
Yes.
Well, I am mainly a linguistic anthropologist, but my background is in political theory first. So I'm always interested in topics that are highly political and that deal normally with democratic functionality, as well as with different kinds of anthropological issues. But politics is my first love, which is also why I got involved in teach-ins. Because I'm interested in studying politics, but also understanding why people do and do not participate in their democratic system and how we can create a space on campus to allow a wider community of people to know more about these issues and to feel like they can participate within their everyday campus lives.
The most recent teach-in was tackling the student debt deficit. So what would you, if you had to summarize that for a very general audience, how would you summarize that?
So our teach-ins have covered a bunch of different issues. We've been doing them since early in 2017 after the last election cycle, and we've been picking different topics to focus on either kind of biannually or annually, and then we try to do a teach-in event around it and then a series of follow-up events, including public debates, to create actual kind of asks that we can ask students to do. So is there a bill coming up that you can vote on? Is there something that you push your legislators to do? And we've been talking about doing this one since the beginning. But we decided to wait until it was an election year to do it because we knew there would be some either some propositions or some things going through the California legislature that we could actually, you know, tell you, hey, here's this thing that you can actually do instead of just making you feel sad about it. Because, you know, like my classes, I just make people feel sad all the time. I'm like, look at this horrible thing, right? This has been an ongoing conversation with our group, and we decided to finally tackle it. So student debt is a completely holistic issue, which is why it's good for anthropologists to cover it, because we could talk about it in terms of finances, but we could also talk about it in terms of mental health costs and physical costs and how it impacts students' decision-making, both in terms of the degree they're going to pursue, the careers they're going to pursue afterwards. So I don't even know where to start. Basically, student lending became a thing in the 1950s. And it became a thing in the 1950s with the whole purpose of bringing middle-class America access to higher education. And it has changed significantly as different administrations have changed the rules on both banking and the funding system for higher education. So obviously as tuition costs increase, which was also decision-making in the federal government about how we fund universities, tuition goes up. That means student lending has to respond to the tuition hikes. So we've seen this increase in tuition since the 1970s significantly, which has come with the defunding of state universities at the federal and state level. Then you have the flip side, which is lending. So tuition goes up, lending goes up, students cannot repay that debt, and here we are.
Here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think so too. I think it impacts so much other things because now you have the student loan debt. You can't buy a house. You have to work multiple jobs, potentially even, just to pay off the student loan portion, the interest rates. And what's crazy to me is that you can be 18 years old, fresh out of high school, and they're going to give you these big loans. And you, like, you know, it's just insane to me that there's not really any accountability for except unpayable debt.
Yes.
Terrible and like interest rates.
Absolutely. And this is like, so I said, this is such a like many-headed problem. It's like, I don't know, a Kraken or something,
mm-hmm.
which was supposed Hydra? To be our Hydra, even better. Yeah. I was thinking of Kraken. Wasn't that supposed to be our mascot?
I think so.
Oh, we picked a shark. Okay. But
even better. Lone shark.
Lone shark. But it, of course, it impacts all of these different areas of life, but it, as first generation college students have increased, the number have increased too, right? There are many things that you encounter. I'm a first generation college student. I'm saddled with loan debt too. And that's in part because I didn't know how to read the package that I was given when I was 17. I didn't know what, I just figured you go to college and then like the federal government helps you.
Right, or you get this amazing job that's going to pay it all back because they're told that you can't get a job unless you have a college degree, so go to college.
Right, and that is in part true because we have a lot of studies that say that social mobility is based on your degrees. So you can't actually move up without getting the degree, but it's a gamble because if you get the degree, you might also have all of this debt to pay off. So it's put people in a real bind. And this particular part of the student loan debt crisis has come since the late 1990s, which has a lot to do with a number of other banking deregulation issues and funding issues with higher education that would make all of the listeners fall asleep. But
so we can fast forward. But it's still interesting.
It does sound interesting.
And it impacts so many people.
Yeah. Like, sheesh.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it really does. It's kind of ridiculous. The Obama administration did some work, right? The situation got really intense, like I said, the late 1990s. Without disclosing my age, I went to college. I did undergrad between 2000 and 2004, which was during the Bush administration, Bush 2, right? Baby Bush. So I went to college during that administration, and that was, so I had a bunch of folks that were advising me. They were like, oh, don't worry about the loans. Like, you can pay like $10 a month for the rest of your life and you're totally fine, because that was their experience. But there was a significant shift in banking and lending in that period, and so nobody knew that they were advising me to take really horrible loans.
Yeah, I have friends that are kind of like maybe 60,000 to 100,000 in debt. They went to grad school and a private bachelor's program. And I'm just like, look at them like they're crazy. I mean, like, yeah, I do have student debt now, but not even close anywhere to that amount. And I still feel like I can't get out of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really taxing to think that you have to take that gamble in order to potentially move up in life. We also treat student debt differently than we treat other kinds of debt. We treat student debt more like we treat credit card debt. Like, it's a kind of debt that doesn't help you do things. If you buy a house and you have a mortgage, mortgage debt is something that you can borrow against. So it's considered positively valued debt that actually allows you to do other things in the world. But student loan debt isn't categorized that way. It's categorized the same way credit card debt is, which is usually a strike against you instead of something that's positive.
And do you think that it is definitely something that should deter people from pursuing college? Or, because in my opinion, I feel people shouldn't be deterred because of the big looming dark phantom of debt that's looming over college.
The debt cloud.
Yeah. But I feel like a lot of people, especially people my age, are very deterred from even trying to go back to college or even start college because of this debt thing that is ever present.
In my opinion, I think that that's why we all need to go out and make sure that the candidates that we want are elected to office that are actually going to do something about the problem. Because it is absolutely true that you are taking a gamble by not getting a degree too, because most jobs that are available for folks who don't have at least a bachelor's don't come with benefits, and we don't have healthcare, right, as available to all humans in the United States unless it's linked to a job or you buy it through open markets, which are unstable based, you know, as it moves from administration to administration. So you can't really get a job that has, or you can, but it's not as likely to be able to move up in society without a bachelor's degree. So I would say go out and campaign for candidates that are going to do things for you, because we need our government to work for us And one way they can do that is by creating a Consumer Protection Bureau for students, which is the current piece of legislation that's moving through the California legislature. It's AB 376. It's a student borrower's bill of rights. So it forces the lending agencies to actually educate you about what it is that they are giving to you. Crazy idea, right? It puts protections in place that protect you from defaulting too. But we don't have a Consumer Protection Bureau, and the lending agencies aren't doing the thing that they're supposed to do, which is that educational portion. They're supposed to, but they don't, and then we don't do anything to them when they don't actually educate you.
Right.
Which seems kind of unfair.
It is.
Yeah. A lot of things are unfair.
Because, like, you put any amount of money in front of a 17 or 18-year-old, they're going to jump at it, you know? But so what can we do about this issue? Like, besides voting somebody into legislation, how can people that already got into student loan debt issues do something about it?
I would also say it's about voting people into office, but if you want specific advice that you don't have to pay for, there are nonprofit organizations that are filling in the gaps right now that the lending agencies are supposed to. One is one of the organizations we worked with for the teach-in. It's called studentdebtcrisis.org. They offer free loan counseling. And so they can actually work with you to move through the process of, like, how to think about your debt, how to repay it, right? What do you do? We're going to work with them to bring some webinars to campus to, like, actually have a space on campus where we'll invite people and, like, order pizza and be like, let's all sit here and figure out what to do with this shit. It's right now it's the nonprofit sector. And because of the way that our financial instruments are so complicated, it depends on what your lending package was, exactly what it is that you need to do about it or with it in order to repay it. But I always go back to, you need to vote people into office that are going to create also either both the protections for borrowers, and personally, it would be great if we had somebody that was willing to eradicate some of that debt.
Oh yeah, I'm voting for that guy. Yes. Or lady or woman. Yeah.
Well, there are two candidates the running for president that would help with student debt, and that's Sanders and Warren. Sanders would eradicate student debt for basically everyone. Warren is up to a certain income level, which would may or may not help everyone that is in the kind of Southern California area, because there tends to be a higher pay scale to deal with a higher cost of living. But both of those candidates have plans to eradicate student debt, knowing that this market was created unfairly and is exploiting our student population. And women and people of color are impacted more significantly.
Yeah, 'cause, like, isn't there, like, a lot more women in college than there are men? Isn't that, like, a percentage or something like that? I read that somewhere.
But it's not just that. Right? It's the same reason that women and women of color in particular were exploited during the 2008 housing crisis, right? When everything, all of those crap loans that they handed out that led to our entire economic system breaking in 2008, that predatory lending was also targeting women and women of color. It's because of the way that risk is assessed in part in that case. So we don't discriminate anymore. We just do risk assessment. And risk assessment is an interesting field that we should all look into that bases the idea of risk in some cases on features that humans have that we might have before called discrimination. Now, in student lending, you see an increase in women of color, new kinds of demographics of people coming into the university at the exact same time that you see these lending practices becoming more predatory. So that's disproportionately impacting people who might not have had access to college before, and now they have access to college and they're getting fucked. I know my classes make everyone feel really sad, but
it's important. It has to be addressed and talked about and put in the open.
Well, I always tell my students when I make them feel really sad when they leave, I say, but, right, y'all might feel really sad right now, but unless you understand the system that you're existing in, there's no way that you can hope to really address change. So if you understand that this shit's taking place, then you can actually figure out how to attack it in ways that are going to be helpful for everyone.
Absolutely. And so would you argue that that's why anthropologists are, one, really important and valuable in these realms? And then also, what do you feel really is an anthropologist's role, especially with these types of situations?
So I think, yes, that's why I think anthropologists are fantastic for addressing these issues, because I think what gets hidden is, one, the holistic and structural nature of these issues. And you have other disciplines that tend to look at it as a demographic issue or an individual issue. But when in reality, this is a structural issue. And to address the problem, you need to look at it structurally and holistically. And I think that's why anthropologists are uniquely qualified to assess this situation in a way and try to help figure out solutions. Now, I hope anthropologists move closer towards the figuring out solutions part, because I think historically we've been very good at telling everybody about how horrible things are, but then not offering solutions. So I'm hopeful that the move towards supporting more practicing anthropologists, which they exist, it's just that our professional organizations haven't been as great at supporting them as they could be. But there's more support for practicing anthropologists, and right, so we can actually also advise people on how to solve these problems. We all need to vote, because this issue is not an individual issue and it's not a financial issue. This is a larger structural issue that can only be solved by legislators at this point and regulating all of the institutions that are continuing to produce this as a problem.
You heard it, guys. Go vote.
Yeah. November 2nd.
And register.
And register to vote, guys. Come on, you guys should be already doing this.
So, kind of segueing away from this topic, I've had the privilege of listening to you present your research last year at a research colloquium. So I was hoping that you would kind of talk to us a little bit about your research, because I thought it was very fascinating. And then also just how you decided to become an anthropologist, and then also why you kind of went the linguistic route.
Triple question.
Here's my spiel. I started out, which we'll also get at the student debt thing, but I started out at I got a scholarship to go to a very private, very bougie, small liberal arts school. And so there, they did not have an anthropology department at all. So I had not heard of anthropology. I had never taken an anthropology class. And I was a political theory, English literature double major. And I also minored in dance studies. And I tried to minor in environmental science, and they were like, good God, please stop. But I could take as many credits as I wanted there with the same amount of money being paid per semester for tuition. So I just took everything. I took classes in everything. And I ended up writing an undergrad thesis on the legal history of hate speech in the United States, because I had to bring together my English literature and my political theory degrees, because you had to write a thesis. So I was like, oh, this linguistics thing is really cool. So I took a year off, and then I applied for master's programs in linguistics. I had planned to go to law school, and then I just didn't go to law school. And I drove to California from the East Coast and lived in Northern California for a year with a friend and tried to figure out what to do. I ended up applying for linguistics master's programs, and I got in, and I started learning about general linguistics, and I had fully planned to go get a PhD in political science, but I ended up in a linguistics department that was embedded in an anthro department. And while I was studying linguistics, they convinced me that I should apply for a PhD in anthropology. So I only applied for a PhD in anthropology. I had never taken a formal class in anthropology before I applied for a PhD in anthropology. But why I ended up in anthropology is because I had talked to people about my interest, and my interest has always been in democracy. And democratic participation and how people think about democracy and what makes democracy work. And they promised me that in anthropology, I could study democracy in the way I wanted to, because I just wasn't into, I just didn't think you were capturing everything about democracy when you were doing statistics. I wanted to talk to people. And anthropology allowed me the methods that could make that happen. So I think that's the how and the why. And then I applied for PhD programs, and I took my first anthro class as a PhD student in anthropology. And, you know, I listened to everyone else tell the stories about, like, I took my first anthro class and it was so cool. And I was like, when they first asked me to teach intro to anthropology, everyone had these stories about, like, the documentaries they watched or the things that they did, and I didn't, because I just took a... I started taking anthro as an anthro PhD. So I have a very different path, I think. But that gets me to write my research. So I went through this meandering path. When I was a linguistics student, I was still interested in political branding and political advertising. And so I wrote all of my major papers for my linguistics master's on political advertising and political branding. And then I did my master's research in Papua New Guinea, and I studied how people conceptualize corruption and democracy in Papua New Guinea, how they talked about it, how they talked about candidates as being good or bad. And I wrote my master's thesis about that and about corruption and state building in Papua New Guinea. And then eventually ended up doing my dissertation research in what is now Trump country in Western Pennsylvania. And I was interested in what was happening on the ground there, and I grew up there. What was happening on the ground there as over my lifetime it moved from a Democratic stronghold to a Republican stronghold. How people were thinking about politics, how they were thinking about talking to their neighbors about politics, what that meant. In terms of, right, if you still have a whole bunch of Democrats and now you have this Republican territory, and increasingly party affiliation is becoming this like major divide in terms of identity, especially post late 90s, what does that mean for your family? Right? What does that mean about talking about politics over the dinner table? And that's what motivated most of my research. I ended up working with a fantastic group of women. They were kind of a grassroots political organization, and they ended up inadvertently giving me fantastic data about how people feel empowered and disempowered, and using language to do politics. Right? How do people talk about it? What language practices do they see as empowering and disempowering? How do people think about their voice literally as having an impact in the political system? And that's where all of my research is situated.
This interview is mind blowing. I'm really learning a lot.
I know.
Okay. Go first, Kayla, so I can get my thoughts together.
No, I think I remember listening to your research before, and I just was so fascinated, especially because I come from a household that I was taught there, you don't talk about politics and you don't talk about religion ever with anybody, because it's, you're going to start problems. And I always would ask the question, like, why should that be problematic to speak about these issues that affect us all as a nation? So it's always really fascinating when I hear people speak about kind of, especially your experience of like this town that was Democratic and then went to becoming Republican, and those kind of ideology shifts?
I mean, I just think it's super fascinating that you, like, you still got to study what you wanted to study at the end of the day. I think that's super great. You got to get wrapped up in politics and democracy, and you, like, put in linguistics into it, and then you have English literature in it, too, and then I don't know how you incorporate the dance, but I'm pretty sure you'll...
Oh, yes, I did. That's because, so increasingly my area of study has also been semiotic analysis. So it allows you to think about embodied action. So recently I just finished writing an article about, in part, how we think about interactions in terms of their mediation, right? So how are they being mediated? Is it more impactful when you're speaking with someone face to face? How do you feel when you are having, or you get a piece of, I don't know, political mail and it has something handwritten in it? Does it seem more authentic? So, but I did incorporate the dance through thinking about embodied action. So I somehow found a way to
incorporate everything.
And I think that is true of anthropology. It's so holistic, and it can it can touch so many different
everything.
Yes.
And I think that's why it's a beautiful blend. Yeah.
I loved it because it allowed me to take that thing that I started in undergrad when I was like, I want to take classes in everything. I found anthropology, and it was the only place where I could literally take classes in anything and find a way to incorporate it into the larger projects that I wanted to do.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The, like, what's the word for it? The something about...
expansiveness?
Yeah, the inclusiveness and expansiveness, the wide variety, of things you can do with anthropology.
It just, I think, reaffirms that anthropology is the answer.
Yeah.
To everything.
An anthropologist can definitely come up with the answer to most things.
Have you talked about Ruth Benedict at all?
We use a quote of hers, but we haven't actually like discussed her work. But I love her work, and definitely one of my inspirations for why I'm an anthropologist.
Yeah, that was one of the first pieces that I read in my, you know, my first semester theory course. It's the very last page of The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, where she talks about how important it is to have anthropology in the world. And that was one of the pieces that I remember most saliently from my first theory course, was that kind of last page of Ruth Benedict.
To make the world safe for human difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That was like her first quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that was what really, I mean, when I read that, I just was like, yes, this is reaffirms this is why I'm here, and this is why I'm doing what I want to do, and these are social issues that anthropologists are qualified to help tackle in some way or another.
But we just got away from like the Benedicts and the Meads of the world that were really embedding themselves in the creation of policy, in planning. They were very involved in those things, and I hope that anthropologists find their way back to that, because I think that we bring a critical perspective that is absolutely necessary in the contemporary era, and actually not just creating policy, but implementing it.
I fully agree.
Yeah, I do too.
So this is another segue, but what is the number one misconception that you deal with when you tell people that you're an anthropologist?
Because I tell them I'm a linguistic anthropologist, they assume that I am a missionary worker. So, because I say, if I ever say I'm a linguistic anthropologist, if I mention that I worked in Papua New Guinea, then they assume that I was somehow doing mission work. Or if I say that I'm a linguistic anthropologist, and I work in the United States, they ask me how many languages I speak. So it's, I think my misconceptions are usually more about the linguistic side of it. And then I think most people that I speak with don't quite know what anthropology is at all, but they fixate on the linguistic part.
Yeah, definitely.
I can also tell you historically why it's rude to, considered rude to talk politics at the dinner table too.
Oh yes, let's hear that.
You want to hear that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Throw it in. Let's go.
Throw this in?
Mm-hmm.
How far back do you want me to go? You want me to go like 1800s far back?
Yeah, that's sexy.
Okay.
Go back.
Okay. So in the 1800s until around the Jacksonian period, voting in the United States was oral, right? You would like hang out in the public square and everybody would stand there, everyone who was eligible to vote at that in that era, and they would yell out who they were voting for. And that was considered a way to keep people accountable. And then all of a sudden you saw this weird shift in the late 1800s where we moved from that kind of oral public voting to what we have now, which is the secret ballot, which we ripped off from Australia, by the way. But it's both the movement of this kind of like the material technology of voting. The move towards that came along with the idea that that was somehow now better because there was a fear that people were being influenced or targeted when they were yelling things out loud in the public square, and that it wasn't about accountability because, right, your political opinion should be secret, so that you're not targeted in any way. That's a very significant shift in thinking about what it means to use your voice in politics, and like literally using your voice. So since that time, since that movement towards the idea that voting should be done in secret and it should be done through this kind of material technology that nobody else gets to see, we've had more and more and more and more of an increase in this idea that your voting and your political opinions should be internal, that they should be private, that they should be secret, and that they're not something that you necessarily need to voice besides through this kind of electoral mechanism. So that shift has gradually occurred. And you see, right, points in time where we have more and more people in the street, right, that are protesting, that are out in the open. But that shift in the way that we vote led to the allowed for the conditions for us to think about talking politics as something that's impolite because it's considered something private and internal.
It makes sense.
That does make sense. I learned so much in this like 30-minute interview that we had here.
I know.
I feel like I just sat in class.
I know, it's good.
But an interactive class where we got to ask all the questions that we wanted to.
We have a mic,
too. Yeah, exactly.
But if you're in my classes, you always have a mic.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Cool. Do you have anything else for me?
No.
I think I'm
good. That was good.
Yeah.
That was great, actually.
Thanks.
We want to thank you for being on the thick.
Thank you for asking me. I love podcasts and I love what you're doing and I love that it is creating something that can make anthropology relevant to the world.
That is our goal, so thank you. We
That's
appreciate
our main
that
goal.
Very much.
And we want to thank you for doing the same.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yeah. Because that's exactly what she's doing. She's making anthropology relevant to like everything.
Real life. Yes.
Yeah, real life. Yeah.
Yep.
Warm fuzzies all around.
Yeah. That was great, Kayla.
Yeah, that was a real mind-blowing interview, I think.
Yeah.
So much information.
So much information. I learned a whole lot.
Yeah.
As Dr. Missy Maseko enforced in her interview, vote. Because your voice does matter.
Yeah. I know this is probably like the 20th, 50th time that we've said these words throughout this episode, but we're just really trying to reinforce how important it is. You gotta vote.
You gotta vote.
You gotta care.
Yes. It's very important.
Yes.
So now, as we bring this next episode of In the Thick, an anthropological podcast, to a wonderful close, you know we gotta do my favorite segment.
You know, we got to do it, Kayla.
I know.
Kayla's quotes.
All right. Yeah. So today's quote is from American anthropologist Claude Levi-Strauss. And the quote is, "I think that a society cannot live without a certain number of irrational beliefs. They are protected from criticism and analysis because they are irrational."
That was wonderful, Kayla. I love it.
Deep. That's a deep thinking one that I'm not going to even unpack that time.
We don't even got time to do all of that. Once again, we want to thank you for listening to another episode of In the Thick.
Yes, thank you.
And we hope you guys have a great, wonderful rest of your day.
Yes.
And we want to also continuously thank you for listening to our podcast every time we air a new episode.
We appreciate you and your support.
We really do.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.